Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast. Drop into our live chat room. Go to TomHartman.com and click the live chat room, or you can get into our blog area if you'd like and participate in that. Welcome back to our program. Three of four adults, and today, by the way, the 22nd of November, the 42nd anniversary of John Kennedy's assassination. And although we discussed that for 2 hours on Friday, but I wanted to make note of it. In fact, our quote for the day from John Kennedy: "A young man who does not have what it takes to perform military service is not likely to have what it takes to make a living." I doubt he was referring to Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney was just a young man at the time. Bob Peters is with us with MoralityInMedia.org. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Bob, your website, your organization is out there aggressively supporting a crackdown by the U.S. Justice Department, Alberto Gonzalez, on obscenity. Do I have that right?
Yes. I rephrase it. See, we'd like him to enforce the law. It's on the books. In our opinion, it needs to be enforced, and we're glad that he's moving forward in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm wondering, how many years in prison do you think that the CEO of Marriott should get for distributing pornography?
I'm sorry, what was the phone moved? How many years?
How many years in prison should the CEOs of Marriott and Holiday Inn and some Hilton, these other hotels that are the largest single entity distributors of pornography in the United States, how many years in prison should they get for distributing pornography?
Well, you know, I'm, at one level, I'm not an excessively harsh man. It seems to me about 3 years, 3 to 5 would be more than adequate. I can remember back in the late 80s, I think there was a case where somebody got sentenced to 25 years in prison. I'm not asking for that, but I think 3 to 5 would be appropriate for the head.
So you're in favor?
Huh?
You're in favor of going after the hotel companies that are, I'm sure you realize the two largest distributors of pornography in the United States, legal, illegal, whatever, all of it, you know, in aggregate, the two largest distributors of pornography in the United States are the hotels and the cable systems.
I've seen that before, that the and it shouldn't come.
It's a billion-dollar business for these guys. In fact, I've seen statistics that show that many hotel chains in the United States would not be profitable if it weren't for the pornography that they sell.
Well, probably their TV system wouldn't be profitable.
No, I mean the entire hotel chain wouldn't be profitable. They're working on a 3 or 4% profit margin, and that profit margin is provided by the fact that almost half of all the people who stay in their hotels are renting a pornographic movie during their stay.
Well, you know, I would bet my bottom dollar that half of the people that stay in their hotel are not renting porn movies. It may be that half the people who rent a movie rent a porn movie, but most people, I don't think, who stay in hotels rent a movie.
Did you see the CBS special on this a year or so ago?
Yes.
I was quite sure that that's what they laid out at that time.
I question, I've kind of learned to, I'm not sure, but I just, when you look at, unless it's a hotel chain that caters to business people, possibly in a situation like
that. Based on estimates provided by the hotel industry, at least half of all guests at hotels such as Marriott and Holiday Inn pay to view adult movies. These orders result in approximately $190 million a year in sales.
Well, it may be that those hotels cater primarily to businessmen, and there's no question that tragically, when businessmen are on the road, they frequently look at pornography.
But and you I don't think that's wrong?
A hotel that was, catering to a cross-section of America, if for no other reason that would include a lot of couples with children and whatnot, and certainly in most cases, couples aren't going to be viewing pornography with their kids or probably with each other.
So I
really question that statistic that half of their customers view adult movies.
Yeah, more than half, actually. And that adult titles are estimated to be viewed 10 times more often than standard fare by business travelers. And they're more expensive. They're typically $6.95 national average compared to $3.95 for other movies. Significant, this is from citizensforethics.org, your own file library.
I'm sorry, I guess our connection is the greatest.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry, Citizens for Ethics is not your website. That's a different one.
Okay.
You're moralityandmedia.org.
Yes.
So number one, okay, so you are in favor of cracking down on the hotel chains.
I wouldn't start there necessarily. I mean, I think, you know, if I were forced to have a choice, I would begin with the internet pornography. At some point, I would go after the cable companies and hotel chains, but keeping this in mind, that historically there have been two types of pornographic films shown by hotels and cable channels, an unedited, hard, by any definition, hardcore pornography type film. There's also what they call cable version, which in my opinion still can be prosecuted, but it's a less explicit. You know, it doesn't show
right.
all the close-ups of penetration and ejaculation and doesn't have... So, you know, you'd have to evaluate what kind of film is being shown at the Marriott.
Yeah, let's keep this family here, Bob. We don't want moralityandmedia.org coming after us. We're talking with Bob Peters, the president of Morality and Media. Bob, do you mind if I personalize this a little bit? This isn't a gotcha, but I want to make a point. If I ask you a couple of personal questions?
Well, you can ask, but I'm not necessarily going to promise
sure.
to answer.
Well, here's the two questions, and I'll just lay them out. Number one, have you ever murdered anybody? And number two, have you ever had sex? And I'm assuming
yes.
that you...
I'll answer.
Yeah, okay. Well, those are the two questions. I'm assuming you've had sex, and I'm assuming you've never killed anybody.
Right.
Okay. So, and I'm assuming that you would agree with me that we really don't want to encourage people to kill other people in our society, and that the vast majority of people in our society at some point in their lives are going to have sex, but they're not going to kill somebody. Is that... Are you with me on that?
Well, as far as I could follow that, I would certainly agree that most people will have sex, and thankfully most people won't kill somebody.
Then why not define pornography? If we're defining pornography as something that people view which is socially unacceptable behavior, and then why not define pornography as those movies that depict violence rather than those movies that depict sex? Why the obsession with sex when it's something that everybody does, and no discussion about the slasher movies, which really not only do none of us do, but none of us should do. Whereas, you know, ultimately, probably most of us should have sex if we want to perpetuate the species. I mean, just from a biological point of view.
Well, you know, I tell you, I'm, at one level, I have to rely on some things I've read, but... You know,
well, I'm talking common sense here, Bob.
Well, you know, particularly when we get into the world of hardcore pornography, you know, most hardcore pornography isn't the sweet stuff. It's not the kind of stuff that, you know, and they're always talking about, you know, men and women viewing pornography together. You know, most pornography isn't produced for couples. It's produced for men, and it's debasing to women. It's degrading. A lot of it does contain an element of sexual violence. So, I mean, there is a type of pornography out there, you know, in which women aren't debased per se, other than the fact that they agreed to perform in the film by my standards, but it's not per se degrading, debasing to women.
But Bob, my point is that
that's the
my point is that even that pornography where women are debased, and clearly we already have some of these definitions. I mean, child pornography is highly illegal, and those laws are strongly enforced even on the internet right now. But even that pornography where women are debased, they're not being murdered. And yet you can, you know, a 15-year-old can walk into a movie theater in America and watch somebody being murdered. What's wrong with our values?
Well,
we're promoting murder,
what?
And we're saying, you know, you can't even have sex. Well, it might be a little debasing. It might be a lot debasing. Still, it's not murder.
Well, I just, you know, this isn't the final answer on the subject, but, you know, back in the Attorney General's Commission on Pornography, they looked at three types of pornography, the violent pornography. All of the commissioners were in agreement that there was a very definite link between violent pornography and sexual aggression. But they also concluded, you know, not as conclusively, but that there was a link between what they defined, and it was, you know, their definition.
Are you talking about the Mies Commission?
A connection between degrading pornography
Bob, we're just about out of time. Are you talking about the Meese connection?
That most pornography was degrading or violent. So again, you know, all of this lovey-dovey stuff, which the industry likes.
I'm not talking lovey-dovey stuff,
really,
Bob.
Really, the exception.
You're going to filibuster me. You know, you're talking about the Edwin Meese connection commission, where Ed Meese personally watched 900 hours of pornography and then came out and declared that it was destructive to watch this stuff.
Well, Ed Meese was the attorney general at that time. But if you look at the composition of the commission, it wasn't the only constituent of the religious right, to my recollection, on that commission, and was James Dobson.
I agree, and I thought it was really weird that all these guys got together and they watched all this pornography, including child pornography and violent pornography, and none of them became twisted, but they said, look out, if you watch this stuff, you'll become twisted.
Well, I don't think they watched all of it. I assume they probably looked at it.
They claimed to have.
But, you know, the studies that they referred to or the investigations weren't all done by the commission.
Well, it's an interesting discussion. We're out of time. Bob Peters, moralityandmedia.org is website. Bob, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Good talking with you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm just an old truth teller. I'm your candid friend.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. Welcome back to the program. Today, 42 years. Boy, where did 21 come from? I don't know. 42 years ago today, John Kennedy's life came to an end in Dallas. Some thoughts from the former president.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal? If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with the taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal. But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
Well said, Jack Kennedy. Indeed. 22 minutes past the hour, by the way. Jack Kennedy, 1960, why I'm proud to be a liberal. And why I'm proud to be a liberal. Well said, Jack. And Jack Kennedy's life ended this day in Dallas through the instrument of Santo Trafficante, Carlos Marcello, Johnny Roselli, working together to organize a hit on this guy. And, well, you know, as we talked about last Friday, I won't bore you with the whole story, but it's the book is now out. Ultimate Sacrifice, of course, the title of the book. You can check it out if you'd like. So, we just lost her. Go to my PC. A lot in the news. Did you catch Bob Woodward last night? It was just absolutely incredible. Bob Woodward was, I tell you, this guy is still carrying water for this administration. It's just remarkable. Bob Woodward comes on the air, and he's going through this whole thing about, well, you know, there really wasn't a crime committed. You know, you noticed the prosecutor didn't actually indict Scooter Libby for the crime of outing a CIA agent, and I don't think there's a crime here. You know, it's the talking points of the administration. And you read his books, and there was a cartoon. I think it was Mike Lukovich. I'm not sure, but there was a cartoon in the Sunday paper, and it showed Bob Woodward in bed between Dick Cheney and George W. Bush, and you know, the earlier one, you know, Bush trying to get into the White House, and then the latter one where he's in bed between these two guys, Bush Woodward trying to get out of the White House. But turns out he's working on a new book about George Bush's second term. So he's still sucking up to these guys in order to, and Larry King was coming at him about this. You know, Bob, aren't you Aren't you sacrificing your journalistic principles? No, I'm not. Yeah, yeah. In fact, he said, here's a few quotes as he tries to rehabilitate himself. He says, the day of the indictment, I read the charges against Libby and looked at the press conference by the special counsel. And he said the first disclosure on all this was on June 23rd, 2003 by Scooter Libby. Now, by the way, that's not what he said. But in any case, he didn't say it was the first disclosure. He said, we'll get into that in a second. The vice president's chief of staff, New York Times reporter Judy Miller, and I went, whoa, because I knew I learned about this in mid-June, a week, 10 days before. Then I say, something's up. There's a piece of the special counsel does not have in all this. And then I went into incredibly aggressive reporting mode. Right. Well, there's a simple explanation, as they point out over at thinkprogress.org, for why Woodward, why Fitzgerald, rather, why the prosecutor, the special prosecutor, didn't have this vital piece of information. Because Woodward didn't give it to him. This is Woodward specific. The only other person who knew was Walter Pincus, and Bob Woodward had told Walter Pincus not to tell anybody. And, of course, Pincus isn't going to go to the special prosecutor because he's not the one who's got the information. He's not the one who talked to the source. So Pincus says he asked me to keep him out of the reporting. I agreed to do that. So first Woodward tells a fellow colleague about the information, but it says don't share it with anybody. Then he doesn't tell his editors, right? So that, quoting Woodward himself, so he doesn't get a subpoena, right? So he can continue to write his book with, and I don't think it's about, you know, gee, I want to have my writing time interrupted. It's about he doesn't want the administration to think that he might be a witness against them. And then he comes out and he criticizes Fitzgerald's investigation. This, in my opinion, is Bob Woodward's way of saying, wink, wink, nod, nod to Bush and Cheney and all the guys in the White House. Don't worry. Continue to be a source for me for this nice book about your second term, and I'll make you look like heroes. This is, the old saying, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. I'll tell you, access to power corrupts, and unlimited access to absolute power corrupts absolutely. And after watching Bob Woodward on TV last night, just speaking for myself, I got to say, I have no interest in reading anything this guy ever writes again, whether it's in the Washington Post or whether it's a book. I just have no interest in it because it's so clear to me that this man's journalistic integrity has been compromised, compromised badly, and compromised obviously for some time now. It's just, and he's out here, essentially flogging his next book and continually mentioning his past books. And, as somebody, as an author, at some level you got to do that, but geez, Bob, give it a break. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, the people down in Florida can't afford a sun bath. The cows in Kentucky can't support a calf. We keep letting Cuba tell us what we can do. We'll be working for Castro before we get through. Please, Mr. Kennedy, won't you help us out?
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, that was one of the songs from that era. From the, pick on Jack Kennedy because Castro's still around. The Kennedy brothers figuring that they had to do something about this or the Republicans were just going to destroy them in the 64 elections. And this had been, of course, the big issue that Richard Nixon used to beat up on Jack Kennedy with in the 1960 election. Or, excuse me, the other way around, that Jack Kennedy used to beat up on Richard Nixon with in the 1960 election was that it was on Nixon's watch as vice president under Eisenhower that Castro had gone communist. So, interesting times. Interesting times. And 42 years ago today, the death of Jack Kennedy. Back to more contemporary issues, and then we're going to get to your phone calls. Our phone number, 866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466, and also feedback from our chat room. You can drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com, and very easy to get in there. So Dick Cheney, amazing. This is consider the logic of this. Just for a moment. You're a police officer. and you go out to somebody's house because you heard that there was a shooting. And the guy comes, you meet the guy out in the front yard, and he says, yeah, I shot my neighbor. He's dead. He's over there in the yard. Or I shot him, and he's bleeding from the leg, and I tied him to a tree or something. You know, whatever. And you're the cop now, and you say, well, why'd you shoot your neighbor? And the guy says, well, because I knew that one day he was going to shoot me. And you say, well, did you feel threatened? I mean, was this justifiable self-defense? Did you have any evidence that he was going to shoot you or to harm you? And the guy says, well, the burden of proof is not mine. The burden of proof is his. He has to prove to me that he's not going to hurt me, or else I get to shoot him. Now, if you were a cop and somebody laid that trip on you, what would your response be? I mean, my response would be, sorry, buddy, off to the hoosegow with you. But that's the exact logic that Dick Cheney tried to lay on the American people yesterday. Just listen to this.
Although our coalition has not found WMD stockpiles in Iraq, I repeat that we never had the burden of proof. Saddam Hussein did.
We never had the burden of proof. We can go to war without any proof. Because your country has failed to prove to us that we shouldn't go to war. Say what? I mean, just consider the logic of that for a moment. Well, I'm sitting here with David Poole, my producer. Well, David, I don't know. I think maybe one day you're gonna turn out to be a bad guy. Where's my gun here? Prove to me you're not gonna be a bad guy someday. Look out, David! Bang! Right? I mean, it's incredible. I got to hear this again. I mean, this is.
Although our coalition has not found WMD stockpiles in Iraq, I repeat that we never had the burden of proof. Saddam Hussein did.
Yeah. Now, if you'll buy that, I got a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn. Here's another one.
Some have suggested that by liberating Iraq from Saddam Hussein, we simply stirred up a hornet's nest.
Yeah.
They overlook a fundamental fact. We were not in Iraq on September 11th, 2001, and the terrorists hit us anyway.
Now, again, if Dick Cheney, in saying these kind of things, doesn't qualify for the Mr. Liar, Mr. Misinformation, Mr. Destroyer of the Truth Award for this century, I don't know who does. Saddam Hussein had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11. I mean, he just had nothing to do with 9/11. It's just that simple. And I think, you know, there's a pretty good consensus about that, in fact. And here's Dick Cheney going, well, on 9/11, we weren't in Iraq. Well, first of all, actually, on 9/11, we were in Iraq. We were bombing Iraq. On the very day of 9/11, we were bombing Iraq. We had been bombing Iraq continuously. In fact, in February of 2001, the Bush administration started bombing Iraq, you know, very aggressively, very seriously, in an attempt to provoke some sort of a response from Saddam Hussein. And we know this now. I mean, Tony Blair and Dick Cheney and George W. Bush talked about this. Let's try and get Saddam Hussein to fight back so that we'll have an excuse to go after him. And he didn't. I mean, we actually bombed the city of Baghdad in February 2001. This is long before 9/11. Trying to produce a provocation, trying to get Saddam Hussein to fight back. He didn't. Why? Because he had no weapons. We had bombed his airports into smithereens. He had nothing. He had, you know, a few anti-aircraft guns and a bunch of kids in rags that was his army. And that was it. And in fact, when George Bush was asked, is there a connection between 9/11 and Iraq?
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No. We have no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with September 11th.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with September the 11th. No.
Now, you get that, and then you get this from Dick Cheney.
Some have suggested that by liberating Iraq from Saddam Hussein, we simply stirred up a hornet's nest. They overlook a fundamental fact. We were not in Iraq on September 11th, 2001, and the terrorists hit us anyway.
Oh, it's just mind-boggling. First of all, he's trying to seize the control of the language. He says, by liberating Iraq, I suspect many of the people in Iraq do not feel particularly liberated right now, and particularly in the big cities. But secondly, here, Well, I guess I've made my point. 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466, our telephone number. We talked about a lot of topics here today. We started out with pornography versus violence, Dick Cheney. Robert in Camino Island, Washington. Hey, Robert. Welcome to the program. Robert, you got to be listening to your phone and not the radio. Ellen in Eileen, in Waynesboro, Pennsylvania. Hey, Eileen, what's up? Eileen?
Oh. Yes.
Yes, you are live and on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi, Eileen.
I agree with you about Bob Woodward. In fact, I'm returning Bush at War to the Washington Post to his boss. I don't even want the book in my house. But anyway, I had an opinion of why Deep Throat revealed who he was in June.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, it was in May when, at the beginning of May, I believe, when the London Times finally, or first, revealed the Downing Street Minutes.
Right.
And it was in the news, and the reporters were asking Scott McCallum questions, and it wasn't going away. And I think this was some kind of favor to the White House from Bob Woodward. I think he coerced, or if not coerced, convinced Mark Felt to come out between Deep Throat just to get the focus off of the Downing Street Minutes.
That's interesting. You know that the strategy, they have this very clear strategy of grabbing the news cycle.
Right.
And your hypothesis makes a certain amount of sense, Eileen.
Yes, and the last two times I saw Bob Woodward on C-SPAN on the book review, he's not the same man.
No.
Mean, he's so obviously not the same man. And
he's sucking up to power. He's just,
yes,
tragically, he's just sucking up to power. Eileen, thank you very much for your comments and for making that point. It's great to hear from you, and thank you for listening there in Pennsylvania.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. Wade in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Wade, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I was going to call to ask if you saw the CNN story today about the Iraqi Shiite leaders asking America for a withdrawal plan.
Yes, in fact, I have the story here. It's among the list of things that I was going to be getting to as we go through the program. Here's the AP version of it. Iraqi leaders call for a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S.-led forces and said Iraq's opposition has a legitimate right of resistance. In other words, the so-called insurgents who are killing American soldiers, according to the leaders of Iraq, have a legitimate right to be shooting at us.
Exactly. It's like even the Iraqi leaders don't want to.
Oh, yeah. This communique was signed off on by Shia, Kurdish, and Sunni leaders on Monday, and it was a clear acknowledgment of the Sunni position that insurgents should not be labeled as terrorists. The conference was held under the auspices of the Arab League and was attended by Iraqi President Talal Talabani and Iraqi Shiite and Kurdish lawmakers, as well as leading Sunni politicians. On Monday, Iraqi Interior Minister Bayan Jabir suggested U.S.-led forces should be able to leave Iraq by the end of next year. And I've been saying all along, we're going to be out of Iraq before the November elections of 2006, because this thing is hanging around the neck of the Republicans like an albatross.
Oh, exactly. What was it going to do with the Iraqi elections that their own leaders were coming out against our coalition forces there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's what they've got to do in order to win the elections. And you make a great point, Wade. I appreciate your calling and sharing it with our listeners. And this is the point also that I've been making, and that is that the reason why the Republicans are foaming at the mouth right now about what Jack Murtha said is not because Jack Murtha had the courage to say the emperor has no clothes, we should get out of Iraq, but because he said it before they did. The Republicans are planning right after the elections in December. That's going to be their fig leaf. They're going to say right after the elections, well, we've had the elections. These guys are voted into office. And so now it's time for us to begin withdrawal. And we'll have 40,000 troops out of there, you know, by February. And we'll have another 50,000 out by July or August. We'll be down to 40, 50,000 troops in time for the elections. And all of them will be withdrawn back to these 17 massive military bases that we're building in the region. And basically, the war will be over, because once we, the irritant, get out of the way, the Iraqis will figure this thing out. People say, well, Iraq needs time to build an army. How long did it take us to build an army after Pearl Harbor? I mean, countries can build an army in a week if they feel sufficiently upset about something. And the Iraqis actually are building an army. It's called the insurgency. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Camelot. Camelot. I know it sounds a bit bizarre.
And welcome back, my friends.
Camelot. Camelot.
Yeah, JFK's favorite song.
That's how conditions are.
9 minutes before the hour, or coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. John Kennedy talking about balanced budgets and economics.
Yes, I have stated in both debates and state again that I believe in a balanced budget and have supported that concept during my 14 years in the Congress. The only two times when an unbalanced budget is warranted would be during a serious recession, and we had that in 58 in an unbalanced budget of $12 billion, or a national emergency where there should be large expenditures for national defense, which we had in World War II and during part of the Korean War.
Yeah, pretty straightforward.
Third, I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
Now, that's pretty incredible when you think about it. Here's Jack Kennedy saying, close up the loopholes on dividends. In other words, start taxing people. Make sure that people who earn their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, that they're paying their full share of taxes. Now, keep in mind, when Kennedy came into office, the top tax rate was 90%. He lowered it to 70%, but he closed all the loopholes. So the wealthiest of Americans were actually paying more in taxes after Kennedy reduced the top rate from 90 to 70% than they were before, because he closed all these loopholes. But the conservatives all run around going, well, Kennedy cut taxes and it increased government revenue. Well, yeah, that's why. That's why when Reagan cut taxes, it didn't increase government revenue. And why when Bush cut taxes, it didn't increase government revenue. And Kennedy comes right out and says that and says, you know, my opponents are lying when they say otherwise. And I just want to be on the record about that.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
And it is. And so the next time some con tries to tell you, well, Kennedy cut taxes. Kennedy closed loopholes and actually increased taxes on the richest Americans. Henry in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Hey, Henry, you're live and on the air. Welcome to the program.
Yes, how you doing today?
I'm just great. What's up?
I just want to call and talk to you about Dick Cheney there. You know, it's just a phenomenal to me how this guy can sit up there, try to reword everything after they just got caught in a dead lie. All the intel information and everything else, and how they're trying to change everything to make it seem like it's our fault as Americans, the reason why they're having problems in the White House and everything else. And how how some of these people out here still believe everything they say. And I'm sitting there going, you know, I can't believe you people. It's just like having a dollar to run your company, and they cut 75% out of it, and then they turn around and try to tell you a lie why they did it. I say, yeah. You people are absolutely nuts. These guys got to go. You know,
yeah. I agree with you, Henry. Well said. Well said. Thank you very much for sharing that. You're very well said. It is spot on. Robert in Camino Island, Washington. Hey, Robert.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What's up?
I wanted to comment on your guy from Morality and Media.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah. You're on.
He was, citing the Mies Commission, which they loaded up with right-wing flunkies and...
James Dobson.
Yeah, and they threw away, Dobson. They threw out any social scientists at all.
Right.
They brought in Andrea Dworkin, who believes that consensual intercourse is tantamount to rape.
Right.
As one of the members of this thing. And, the earlier commission that had been done that was filled with, it had clergymen, also had psychologists, they had found not only no harm, but a beneficial result from legalizing pornography. Denmark and Sweden, when they legalized pornography, had a drop in their rate of rape and child molestation.
And other sex crimes as well, yeah.
Yeah, and, there's an article in the 2000, November 23rd, 2000, Rolling Stone, The Media Violence Myth by Richard Rhodes, that, you know, it talks about the shoddy science and the shadowy motives that the politicians love to quote of all this so-called research that proves a link between violent films and pornography.
Yeah, this is the thing I don't get. Why are these guys so afraid of sex and their embracing of violence?
Well, that's
they're gung-ho for a war, and they don't want anybody to watch somebody having sex. I don't get it.
Well, the thing is, I've made erotic videos, and nobody's degraded on this video. I mean, these people were, you know, it's a very pleasant advocate for adult video, and these weren't hardcore, but there can be really horrible working conditions and everything, but it's not automatic. And these people, I think, see sex as so degrading, and the human.
Well, that's my point. I think even S&M videos that are done by consensual adults, you know, presumably. I'm not talking about snuff movies here or something like that, should be illegal.
Automatically, to do sex is to degrade yourself. To do it publicly or to do it on video is automatically degrading to anyone, especially if they want to say that they care about.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. I don't buy the premise, but even if that premise was right. I would say, even if it was right, and I'm not saying that, but even if it was, it's still not as bad as teaching people to kill.
Right, and
you go to a Schwarzenegger movie, and what are you getting? Violence.
Yeah, but the thing is, if they want to say they protect women, but they want to take away all women's rights, including the right to choose to be in an adult video, but they don't care about whether women are degraded. I mean, I just don't buy it. That's a cloak.
It's about control. It's all about control, Robert. This is the rise of patriarchy.
The thing is that I don't mind violence in movies. It depends on how the violence is contextualized. And the thing is that a lot of the movies they celebrate, the person committing the violence is depicted as a hero rather than pathological or a villain.
Right. Yeah, and that's what the Bush administration is trying to recast itself as. You know, George Bush, he's Superman. Now, the problem is, Superman would be a really boring comic strip if there wasn't some evil, dark genius out there. That's why these guys are not going to admit that Osama bin Laden or Zarqawi are dead. You know, because you've got to have an enemy in order to have a hero. And as long as Bush is going to try and play the hero, he's got to have an enemy. And the same thing with the pornography. That's the enemy. We're the heroes. Come on, guys. We have some serious social problems. We got people who are hungry. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Tom Hartman.
Yes, and every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back to our program, my friends. Our quote for the day from Dwight Eisenhower. I like to believe the people in the long run are going to do more to promote peace than our governments. Indeed, said Eisenhower. I think the people want peace so much that one of these days governments had better get out of the way and let them have it. Peace, the it that he's speaking of. John Kennedy, our quote from Kennedy for the day, today the 42nd anniversary of the assassination of JFK. New book out about it, by the way. If you go to tomhartman.com and just click on Solved Who Killed JFK, you can read all about it. Anyhow, our JFK quote for the day, every American ought to have the right... let me read a different one here. Economic growth without social progress lets the great majority of people remain in poverty while a privileged few reap the benefits of rising abundance. Indeed. Welcome back to our program, brought to you today, by the way, this hour by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. It's time for our Bioneers segment for the week. Bioneers. It was founded in 1990, a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring Earth and communities. Our guest, Omer Freya, director of Green Workers Cooperatives, greenworker.coop. Hey, Omar, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
It's a Freya? Am I pronouncing
it?
Say it again.
Freya.
Freya. Oh, okay. And I didn't realize that there was a domain, or whatever it's called, of .coop. Is this new?
Yes, actually it is. It's specifically for cooperatives and co-op related groups and activities. So it's,
that's great.
Yeah, it's something that is, you know, being pushed out there, and if anybody's part of a worker co-op or consumer co-op, housing co-op, you're all eligible for it.
Okay, www.greenworker.coop, or coop, is kind of how it looks, but it's co-op, C-O-O-P. And Omar, tell us about what you've done in the South Bronx.
Well, we've been working, we're a new organization, Green Worker Cooperatives, and you know, our focus is really to deal with the legacy of environmental racism and classism that has plagued the South Bronx for at least about 40 years.
Or arguably 140 years.
Well, you know, the history in the South Bronx in particular has been a history of transitions. But, you know, certainly the overarching problem that we come out of is the fact that whenever we're talking about poor neighborhoods, low-income communities, communities of color, these are the same places where you'll find the worst of polluting infrastructure. And it's not necessarily a case of, you know, people moving into areas where these things are. But it's in many cases, it's the reverse. And, you know, oftentimes if you've got one waste facility, people in government look the other way when another one comes in. And they say, well, you've got one, you can handle two. You've got 10, you can handle, you know, another five more. And so we've seen this legacy of change where communities have become darker, they've become poorer, and then one after another of, it doesn't matter whether it's a power plant, a waste facility, any kind of a sewage sludge processing operation, you know, all of these things wind up being sited in the same select few neighborhoods. And at the end of the day, you know, for those of us who live in places like the South Bronx and other parts of the country as well where the same situation arises, we always get promised the same things. Whenever another company or a city agency decides that they want to build another one of these things, there's always the promise of jobs. Everybody's hungry for jobs. You know, we all now know that, you know, another 30,000 people have been laid off by GM.
Yeah.
You know,
here in the Pacific Northwest, it's the same thing. You know, it's you get the average working person all excited about, hey, we got to cut down all these forests, you know, because it's a job. And when somebody's faced with the choice of being environmentally sensitive on the one hand or starving on the other, it's not a difficult choice, frankly.
Right.
You know, I'd rather not starve. I guess it would be between being environmentally sensitive or eating, on the other hand. Right. I'd rather eat. And so it seems that what we have to do is say it's not just this you know, Hobson's choice. It's not just these two that there is an alternative, and that's what you guys are championing. The alternative is that we can have jobs and have a reasonable environment and accomplish the things that the dirty industries were purporting to accomplish in a way that's not dirty. Is that a good summary?
Exactly. We push job creation harder than anyone else in industry does when it comes to neighborhoods like ours, because we need jobs. South Bronx is actually the poorest urban county in the United States. Unemployment rates in
at this moment.
At this moment, right now,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Unemployment rates in some parts are as high as 27%. You know, so the need for jobs is desperate, and we certainly need it. But we don't want jobs that kill people. You know, we want jobs that don't exploit people or the earth. We want jobs that where the workers aren't worried about, you know, their lungs or, you know, what they're going to wind up giving to their kids or their family when they come
home.
Or
so,
the
Omar,
people
what
who
are you...
live around them.
Right. So what are you doing to solve this problem, Omar?
Well, our focus is to create jobs, to actually create businesses that are owned by the workers. So that's the cooperative in our name. And at the same time, these would be cooperatives or businesses that are green in one form or another. So we're starting with our very first one. So, you know, I've had a long history of doing kind of environmental justice organizing and rallying against polluters, and now I'm actually wearing a different hat and trying to start up a business. You know, so we're starting up our first one. In a sense, it would be like a worker-owned Home Depot for used stuff. You know, we would basically take the building materials that wind up getting thrown out whenever someone does a home renovation, and instead of sending it off to a landfill, we would keep it right here, put it in a warehouse, and if someone wants a nice kitchen set of kitchen cabinets or windows, and we'd have it right there available for people.
It's
really amazing the amount of waste that there is. In even a place here like New York City, we've got 8 million people, And, you know, it's just amazing. Whenever someone renovates their kitchen, especially in the wealthier parts of the city that generate even the greatest amounts of waste, you've got beautiful stuff that just gets thrown out on the curb and or thrown into a dumpster, and it's completely trashed and made unusable, where there are plenty of people that would love to be able to get a deal on their on building materials, especially nowadays with building materials going up in prices. You know, so being able to do that, we feel serves a creates a benefit, not just an environmental benefit because you're getting rid of the waste, but you're also creating an economic benefit, not just in terms of the jobs, but you're really lowering the price of building materials for people who really need it.
We're talking with Omar Freeh of greenworker.coop. This really raises two interesting questions. The first is, how do you deal with gentrification? I mean, right now you've got realtors. Alex, my board op in New York, we were talking about this. He says realtors in New York are now referring to the South Bronx as Sobro, you know, sort of like Soho. Like it's you know, the place where yuppies are moving. The Fulton Fish Market just moved there. So how do you deal with, you know, if you improve the neighborhood, then you also make it a target for gentrification on the one hand. And on the other hand, if that doesn't happen, or whether that happens or not, how do you also deal with the fact that supposition that one of the main reasons why toxic industries are dumped in communities like this is because the people are not perceived as being politically active and politically potent, and so, you know, the politicians don't care. How do you get them active?
Well, to deal with the first issue about gentrification, it's definitely a reality.
And we have about a minute and a half, by the way. I'm sorry.
Okay. I was actually just priced out of a neighborhood that I lived in. But it's something that when we talk about creating a new economy, one that's democratic, one that's where workers have an ownership stake, then you're really talking about empowering the people who actually live in the neighborhoods and putting more money in their pockets so that they don't have to leave the neighborhood. Doing the same thing with housing. People control the housing. It's really about creating an investment for people who are actually already there. And then you're really able to build a stable economy where people don't feel the need to leave and be forced out of the neighborhood. So it's really about community control, and that transfers to organizing and to people taking over, making the decisions for what happens in their neighborhood. We live in a democracy, but very few people ever actually experience democracy. You know, and when we talk about being able to experience that at work, that is completely radical and revolutionary. You know, we don't often get a chance to really determine our own destiny or what happens in our day-to-day lives. And that kind of thing is really an education that transfers beyond the halls of work, but it goes on into your community and into where you live and where you work and where you play. And anyone can transfer those lessons to their daily life and, you know, take that into a meeting with an elected official and say, you know, I'm used to making decisions where I work, and now I want to make a decision about what happens here in my community.
Sounds like a plan. Omar Freeh, the Green Worker Co-op, www.greenworker.coop. Check it out on the website. Omar, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you.
Keep up the great work. Sounds fascinating what you're doing there in the South Bronx. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
I dreamed I was the president of these United States. I dreamed I replaced ignorance, stupidity, and hate.
Welcome back, my friends.
I dreamed the perfect union and the perfect law undenied.
21 minutes past the hour.
All I dreamed that I forgot the day John Kennedy died.
There you go. That's today. Welcome back. It's the 42nd anniversary of the death of John Kennedy, JFK. One of our greatest presidents. I mean, this guy really, really did a marvelous job. And I want to hear a little bit more from him. Here's John Kennedy.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I accept your nomination and I am proud of it.
This is where he's accepting his nomination for President of the United States. George Meany in the room.
I am proud to be the only candidate in 1960 with the nomination of two political parties, although I'm not certain how many tickets are now headed in how many states by Senator Goldwater. We had an interesting convention at Los Angeles, and we ended with a strong Democratic platform, which we called the Rights of Man.
The Thomas Paine's word.
The platform has also been presented. I do not know its title, but it has been referred to as the power of positive thinking.
Yeah. And now he gets into the substance of the issue here.
I do not regard the title of liberal as an honorary degree. I regard it as a license to preach the gospel of liberalism across this country. But I think you know why this title could be conferred on my candidacy. Just before you met, a weekly news magazine with wide circulation featured a section entitled Kennedy's Liberal Promises and described me, and I quote, as the farthest out liberal Democrat around, unquote. While I am not certain of the beatnik definition of farthest out, I am certain that this was not intended as a compliment. And last week, as further proof of my credentials, a noted American clergyman was quoted as saying that our society may survive in the event of my election, but it certainly won't be what it was. I would like to think he was complimenting me, but I'm not sure he was.
There you go, John Kennedy. We'll come back with a little more of that. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service with us. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Okay.
Hey, Ellen.
You know, hi.
Hey, Ellen. It's Tom. You're live and on the air.
Oh, all right. I am in Mississippi right now, Tom. And as you know, we actually came up with an idea. They are not delivering a lot of the FEMA trails that are available. We're going to try and maybe hook up a webcam so that we can count how many FEMA trailers are there on a regular basis and that they're not giving out.
Oh, wow. That would be incredible. I mean, FEMA has a whole... Now we're talking... housing trailers, right? These are like mobile homes.
And yesterday, I ran into a teacher. I was actually at a high school who is a full-time teacher and coach, and she is living in a tent in her front yard because FEMA has not yet gotten her a trailer.
That's incredible.
And she's entitled to it.
Now, our tax dollars given to FEMA. FEMA buys these trailers, these mobile homes, probably from some company that's a subsidiary of Halliburton, who, you know, heaven only knows. They take them down there, and they're sitting empty while we've got people who are going to be thrown out of hotel rooms all over the United States just in time for the holidays, and they're sitting empty. Why?
Because somehow FEMA has not managed to get them to the people that need them.
They can't find the keys?
Keys to some of them now. I'm trying to check that out. I heard that from somebody down here, and I'm trying to check that out with FEMA. I doubt whether FEMA's going to admit that to me, but I'm about to call FEMA and find out what happened to this one person, because the only way you can really find out what the bureaucracy is to follow one or two cases to the end and really see what has happened, because otherwise you just get FEMA jibber-jabber. That's all.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's a joke that I was a former judge down here. I met him yesterday in a coffee shop. I was supposed to meet him at a coffee shop. And the joke is, how many female employees does it take to repair a building? It doesn't matter, they say. They're not coming anyway.
I see a whole new generation of light bulb jokes FEMA jokes.
Well, yeah,
right?
And the other joke around here is that Jesus in the desert, he's hot and sweaty, he's thirsty, he's sticking, and all of a sudden he sees somebody next to him, and he thinks it's Satan, but no. The guy says to him, I'm only the insurance adjuster.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a tragedy, though. The insurance companies now are saying, oh, you thought you had flood insurance? Sorry, there's a clause in your flood insurance that says you're not protected against a flood.
Right. Or people did have, who were not in the flood zone, had wind damage insurance. Well, if a if a huge tree fell on their house and then rainwater came in, they're calling that flood damage, even though it was originally from the wind.
I want to know where the federal agencies are who are supposed to regulate the insurance industry. I mean, this is absolutely...
There is none. And, you know, when you die, you have to collect, you can collect life insurance in 7 days. They can string you along for months.
Yeah, incredible. Ellen Ratner, talkradionews.com, the website. Ellen, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Good talking with you today. We'll see you tomorrow. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Please, Mr. Kennedy, won't you help us out? Now, I know some people that's got it made. They're setting back a living off of foreign aid. You don't help us, then we insist you add South Carolina on to that list. Please, Mr.
Kennedy. The political music of 1960. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour, coming up on 25 before the top of the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website. If you want to drop into our live chat room, simply click live chat. If you want to find out who killed Kennedy, click the link, who killed JFK. Speaking of JFK, let's listen to a little bit more of that speech of his. This is a great speech where he's talking about liberal virtues.
But a more serious challenge to my credentials, this time as a Democrat, was issued in Dallas, Texas. In his address to a large gathering of Texas Republicans, and there are no pure breed any place in the United States, Mr. Nixon complained that what he called the party of Schlesinger, Galbraith, and Bowles was not the party of Jefferson, Jackson, and Wilson. I do not agree. But I have no intention of issuing a similar challenge to my opponent's credentials. For I know full well that the party of Nixon, Dirksen, and Goldwater is the party of Hoover, Harding, Coolidge, McKinley, and the rest.
The disgraced Republicans. It's great. Just turning it around. Yeah, the Nixon disgraced Republicans. Yeah. And it still is the party of Hoover.
The final proof is the old political adage that you can tell a friend by the enemy that he makes. And by this standard, you and I are the closest of friends. For Mr. Nixon and Mr. Dirksen and Mr. Mott and Mr. Goldwater don't like my liberal policies, I'm glad to say, any more than they do yours. They are fighting a rearguard action against the 20th century, and they fear that our time is coming and theirs is going. I do not mean to say that the fight is wholly between the Democratic and the Republican parties. Those of you who are here tonight are proof of the fact that some of the best friends that the Democrats have are not in the Democratic Party.
This is a guy who really reached out across the aisle.
I think in November that some of them may be in the Republican Party. But I hold out no hope at all for the vast and impressive number of Republicans who suddenly, just before election time, those who are running for office, suddenly begin to sound like true religion. 8 years ago on this occasion, Adlai Stevenson called this quadrennial outburst of affection that pause in the Republican occupation known as the liberal hour.
Yeah, Adlai Stevenson. And now what Stevenson was talking about was that whenever the Republicans are up for re-election, suddenly they're in favor of things like Social Security. But really, they're working against it most of the time. Now, at least with Bush, to some extent, we're seeing the true Republican agenda, which is if it's good for big business, that it's good for the Republicans. If it's good for inherited wealth, it's good for the Republicans. If it has to do with helping the average working person, tough. Screw them. We don't need them. That's the Republican position. And it has been for, here, this is from 40 years ago.
And he added, it should never be confused, and he was right, with any period when Congress is in session.
Yeah. Another bit of a joke there. This is John Kennedy from 1960, accepting his nomination.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal?
If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with the taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal. But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
Where, one has to ask, where are the Democratic politicians today who would speak so honestly about this, who would reclaim this word? Where have they gone?
But first, I would like to say what I understand the word liberal to mean and explain in the process why I consider myself to be a liberal and what it means in the presidential election of 1960. In short, having set forth my views, I hope for all time 2 nights ago in Houston, on the proper relationship between church and state, I want to take this opportunity to set forth my views on the proper relationship between the state and the citizen. This is my political credo. I believe in human dignity as the source of national purpose, in human liberty as the source of national action, and the human heart as the source of national compassion, and in the human mind as the source of our invention and our ideas.
I mean, this is it's, the contrast between John Kennedy and his vision of America is, and Dick Cheney and George Bush and the modern Republicans, the DeLays, the Frists, and their vision is so stark. It is so stark. It's remarkable. It's just.
It is, I believe, this faith in our fellow citizens, as individuals and as people, that lies at the heart of the liberal faith. For liberalism is not so much a party creed or a set of fixed platform promises, as it is an attitude of mind and heart, a faith in man's ability, through the experiences of his reason and judgment, to increase for himself and his fellow men the amount of justice and freedom and brotherhood which all human life deserves.
And once again now, instead, we've got a guy who wants to suspend to push the Patriot Act and suspend civil liberties, throw people in jail without trial.
I believe also in the United States of America, in the promise that it contains and has contained throughout our history, of producing a society so abundant and creative and so free and responsible that it can not only fulfill the aspirations of its citizens, but serve equally well as a beacon for all mankind. I do not believe in a super state. I see no magic to tax dollars, which are sent to Washington and then returned. I abhor the waste and incompetence of large-scale federal bureaucracies in this administration, as well as in others. I do not favor state compulsion when voluntary individual effort can do the job and do it well. But I believe in a government which acts, which exercises its full powers and its full responsibilities. Government is an art and a precious obligation. And when it has a job to do, I believe it should do it. And this requires not only great aims, but that we propose concrete means of achieving them. Our responsibility is not discharged by an announcement of virtuous ends. Our responsibility is to achieve these objectives with social invention, with political skill, and executive vigor. I believe for these reasons that liberalism is our best and our only hope in the world today.
Liberalism, our best and only hope in the world today.
Liberal society is a free society, and it is at the same time, and for that reason, a strong society. Its strength is drawn from the will of free people committed to great ends. and peacefully striving to meet them. Only liberalism, in short, can repair our national power, restore our national purpose, and liberate our national energies. And the only basic issue in the 1960 presidential campaign is whether our government will fall in a conservative rut and die there, or whether we will move ahead in the liberal spirit of daring, of breaking new ground, of doing in our generation what Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman and Adlai Stevenson did in their time of influence and responsibility.
He's essentially quoting Washington.
Our liberalism has its roots in our diverse origins. Most of us are descended from that segment of the American population which was once called an immigrant minority. Today, along with our children and grandchildren, we do not feel minor. We feel proud of our origins, and we are not second to any group in our sense of national purpose. For many years, New York represented the new frontier. To all those who came from...
I'm going to wrap the Kennedy speech up at this point, because now he gets into this. He's speaking in New York City to a group of New Yorkers, and he starts talking about New York and wanders off. But his discussion of liberalism in many ways is almost a verbatim echo in some pieces of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and the founders who used the word liberal, a word that was used to describe the period of the Enlightenment of the 1600s, when Locke and Rousseau and others were writing that it was possible for human dignity to be a superseding value, that a government could actually consider happiness to be something so important it would put it in its founding document, like the Declaration of Independence. These were liberal ideas. This country is a liberal country. It was founded on liberal ideals. As George Washington said, I hope I shall ever see America becoming more liberal. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
In 1961, when Ike went out, the people in the South began to shout. In the last 8 years, everybody starved to death. The people up in Lucknow ain't even got breath. Please, Mr. Kennedy, won't you help us out?
And thank you very kindly. Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, 9.5 minutes before the hour. A little political music there from the year 1960. Amazing. Amazing. And it just, you know, it's today, of course, the 42nd anniversary of the death of John Kennedy. It really reminds us of what we lost. Not just in losing John Kennedy and then Robert Kennedy and then Martin Luther King, the assassinations of liberals and progressives. And I don't recall any conservatives being assassinated, but not just in that we lost, but what we have lost since then, as the public dialogue has been seized by radical right-wingers like Ronald Reagan and George Bush, and the damage that's been done to this country since then. Here we have General Motors now laying off 25,000 people in the United States, 30,000 people worldwide. It used to be, you know, what's actually the correct quote from the former chairman of the GM, I'm forgetting his name, was what's good for America is what's good for GM. It's often misquoted as what's good for GM is good for America. But the point is that what's bad for America is bad for General Motors. And what's bad for America is this insane conservative economic and trade policies that have been pursued since Ronald Reagan through George Herbert Walker Bush, really cemented into place by Bill Clinton and the DLC Democrats, and then promoted even more aggressively by George W. Bush. In this, they're in absolute agreement, Democrats and Republicans, conservative Democrats and Republicans, in absolute agreement that the rights of a multinational corporation are more important than the rights of a working person in the United States of America. That the profits of a multinational corporation are more important than the income of average Americans. that the wealth of the country is irrelevant compared to the wealth of multinational corporations. And so we've gone, when Ronald Reagan came into office, 70% of Americans had the kind of job, your basic union job. 35% of the American workforce was unionized. And for every union job, there's an equivalent job out there in the workplace. When Reagan came into office, you had 70% of the American workforce able to put their kids through school, through college, able to pay all of their medical expenses, full health care, have a pension for their retirement, able to take a vacation, able to buy a home and a car, the middle-class American dream. When Reagan came into office, 70% of Americans were living the American middle-class dream. Today, we have as many as 10 million Americans who are going hungry on any given day, as many as 30 million Americans who are what's called food insecure. They literally don't know if they're going to have food next week. I mean, how far are we going to have to fall before the American people say enough? How deep does this have to go? How close to the bone does this have to cut? The kind of damage that is being done to America by these insane conservative economic policies, whether they're pursued by a Democrat, like as in the case of Bill Clinton, or whether they're pursued by a Republican, as in the case of Reagan and Bush. I mean, how far do we have to go? Russell Mulkeber and Robert Weissman on Common Dreams, reviewing a new book by Chuck Collins, Economic Apartheid in the United States. Point out, of the world's 100 largest economies, 47 are nations, 53 are corporations. 75% of major corporations hire a consultant to stop employees from forming a union. Top executives now make more in a day than the average worker makes in a year. 42% of those people listed in the Forbes 100, the 400 wealthiest Americans, 42% of them got there by inheriting their money. Is this the kind of society that we want to live in? The world's 225 richest people now have a combined wealth of $1 trillion. That's equal to the combined annual income of the world's 2.5 billion poorest people. 225 people have a combined wealth equal to the annual income of 2.5 billion human beings. The richest 10% of the world's population receives 49.6% of the total world income, and the bottom 60% receives 13.9% of the world's income. The wealth of the world's three most well-to-do individuals now exceeds the combined gross domestic product of the 48 least developed countries in the world. Half the world's population, 6 billion people, 3 billion, half the world's population lives on less than $2 a day, and over a billion, 1.3 billion, live on less than $1 a day. And we're saying, this is the world that we want. I don't think so. Stretch limousines are getting longer, yet more people are homeless. Meanwhile, entire urban and rural communities are crumbling. And what does Bush want to do? More tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. At what point do we wake up and say, hey, wait a minute, what's going on, what's happening with GM is emblematic of what's happening all across the United States, and you can lay the responsibility of it right at the feet of George Bush, Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, and Bush Sr. And it started with Reagan. We built the most powerful industrial machine in the world, the United States of America, between 1787 and 1980. And we built it with trade policies using tariffs to protect our domestic industries and to encourage business. And we built it by enforcing the Sherman Act and keeping businesses from getting so big that they became anti-competitive. And we built it by saying, if you're going to do business in the United States, you're going to have to pay taxes in the United States. And now we have Halliburton reincorporating Kellogg Brown and Root offshore so they don't have to pay taxes on the tax money that is given to them to rebuild Iraq or New Orleans for that matter. I mean, what's wrong with this picture? Well, what's wrong with it is a lot. And Americans are waking up and saying enough already. And everybody's all the pundits, all the millionaire pundits on television sitting around scratching their heads going, gee, what are people so upset about? It looks like, the Republicans are not in favor anymore. I wonder why. Could it have something to do with the death of the American middle class as a result of these insane economic policies? I think so. 57 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. You're going to take the, what was it, the red pill or the green pill, I believe it was. Or was it the red pill or the blue pill, right? It was blue, okay. And the red pill was supposed to be the good pill. Gee, I wonder if that was an embedded message that the Republicans put in there. You know, product placement, right? It's like the tobacco companies do it. It's incredible. A slight digression, but one that maybe, you know, has some entertainment value for you, I suppose. Some years ago, about a decade ago, I wrote two novels that got we sold options to for the screenplays to a production company in Hollywood. And in the pre-production stuff, and I was flying out to Los Angeles, you know, back and forth over a period of a couple of months. I mean, for every 10,000, you know, books that get optioned, one gets made into, maybe for every 100,000, one gets made into a movie. Mine wasn't one of the ones that gets made, but I had a kind of a glimpse behind the curtain. And in the pre-production work, where they, you know, where you're putting together the screenplay, and we already had a production company. It was actually an actor whose name you would recognize, who owned the production company. One of the things that they were trying to do was raise the money to make the movie, and they were looking at various sources for the pre-production money. And one of the things that they told me was that if I could write into the screenplay characters who smoke cigarettes, for every character who smoked in the screenplay, we could get $100,000 from the tobacco lobby or thereabouts. You know, I forget the exact amount of money, but it would go. And because it was pre-production money, it wouldn't be considered a product placement, and it wouldn't violate certain federal laws against that, because this was before the screenplay was actually written. And apparently there are some rules about after the screenplay is written, you know, then you've got to divulge or whatever. And I don't know how those rules have changed this was at least 10 years. You know, this is probably more like 15 years ago that this happened. But in any case, it could be done early on. And so the pressure was on me to write make the hero smoke cigarettes. Strangest thing. And then that's when I started noticing that, you know, while what, 10-15% of the population smokes now? I mean, I don't frankly know the percentage, but it's fairly relatively low here in the United States compared to what it was during my father's generation, where when my dad went off, he joined the army during World War II got, just as the war ended, got sent off to Japan during the occupation. And, you know, every GI got two cartons of cigarettes every month. You know, it's just part of what they got. And so you had an entire generation of people, like my father, who became tobacco addicts. And you know, and then my mother became a tobacco addict and all that kind of stuff. Ronald Reagan on TV with his Chesterfields, you know, smoke them. If you have a sore throat, it's good for you and all that kind of stuff. And at that point, I think that we probably had, I don't know, 35, 40, 45, maybe even 50% of America was smoking. And what we're seeing, in my opinion, one of the reasons why we're seeing increased longevity right now, the average lifespan of Americans is starting to increase slowly, but it's starting to increase, is because the smoking generation is dying off and the non-smoking generation is starting to pick up. So, you know, we'll see. I was part of that smoking generation, and then I quit when Louise became pregnant with our oldest child, which was 32 years ago. So anyhow, pardon that the digression. I just... it's fascinating how things work, you know, how things go around. And Katrina, the relief effort's losing steam. This is from the Center on American Progress. The effort to rebuild New Orleans has been largely unfulfilled. Why? Well, because of a leadership vacuum in Washington, D.C., where President Bush and Congress have been preoccupied for weeks with Iraq deficit reduction. They call this deficit reduction, right? Slashing social programs and giving tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires. That's called deficit reduction. The CIA leak investigation in the Supreme Court. Unlike responses to similar tragedies such as 9/11, which happened in a high-profile, high-media-profile city of New York and happened mostly to people who were relatively affluent, some of them, many of them millionaires and multimillionaires. Not many of them, some of them. The majority of them probably Caucasian. White European ancestry. Unlike responses to similar tragedies such as 9/11, relief legislation remains dormant in Washington, and despair is growing among officials in New Orleans who fear that Congress and the Bush administration are losing interest in their plight. Walter Isaacson of the Louisiana Recovery Authority said, "We're still relying on the president's promise to help build help New Orleans rebuild." Right. You're relying on a promise from George W. Bush? Somehow I think we're in big trouble. Anytime, you know. Meanwhile, 6,644 people remain missing in the Gulf region. They're still finding bodies. And the New Orleans coroner is on record as saying that he's guessing that a lot of bodies simply got washed out to sea. Or into the Gulf of Mexico, raising the prospect that the death toll could be much higher than the 1,306 recorded so far in Louisiana and Mississippi. I'm telling you, more people died in Hurricane Katrina as a result, in large part, of things like FEMA telling the governor of Louisiana and the mayor of New Orleans not to use the school buses because FEMA was going to be sending air-conditioned buses and then forgetting to do it. More people we will find that more people died in Katrina than died in 9/11. But is Dick Cheney going to be running around at every opportunity dropping the Katrina bomb the way he drops the 9/11 bomb? Are they going to use Katrina to justify invading Venezuela? You know, we got to take out that Hugo Chavez guy. He's down there in the southern hemisphere, or close to it, where all these hurricanes originate. Haven't you noticed all the hurricanes start out as tropical depressions just off the coast of Brazil? Maybe we need to take out Lula. Maybe we need to take out Brazil. Maybe it's time to go after you. Yeah, right. I'm just, you know, a nation cannot afford to forget the lessons of Katrina. We've got to go after Hugo Chavez and all those Citgo gas stations that he owns. Another thing that's amazed me, that Citgo is a Venezuelan-owned company, and when you buy your gas at Citgo, instead of your money going to Osama bin Laden's instead of your money going to the country that supplied 14 of the 19 hijackers. You know, the old bumper sticker, when you drive alone, you're driving with Osama. And when you buy your gas at a Citgo gas station, instead of your money going to Saudi Arabia, it's going to Venezuela, and the profits are used to provide housing for the poor, medical services for the poor, and food for the poor. I think that's pretty amazing. Pretty impressive. And on their website, you can find local Citgo stations around you, by the way, if you want. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Bob in Chico, California. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Yes.
What's on your mind today?
Just wanted to express that I think it is a farce to attempt to export democracy to Iraq or any place else when we're having trouble with it here in America, in that in the 2000 and 2004 elections, there is a huge cloud of questioning and controversy over these elections, in that some precincts have come back with, oh, we had 108% participation. No. I'm shocked that nobody has been arrested so far on voter fraud charges because of this.
Yeah, our talking about exporting democracy is like, you know, a professional burglar going out and preaching the benefit of never stealing. I mean, it's of a wife beater talking about domestic tranquility. I mean, the problem is, you know, we created democracy here in the United States 200 and plus years ago, but the Bush administration, actually, let me rephrase that. It's not our, as in the United States, exporting democracy, as it were. It's the Bush administration. But the reality is, you know, what Dick Gregory, I love telling this story. Dick Gregory and I were flying over to Africa back in 1981. And he said, you know, what I don't understand, why we're running around the world trying to shove democracy down people's throats with the barrel of a gun. He says, when you got something good, you don't have to force it on people. They will steal it. And I mean, that's the reality, right? It's like the way you export democracy is by living it, by being the example of it.
Mm-hmm.
And spot on, Bob, and thank you for your comment. We are not being the example of it. We are being an example of actually a democracy under assault. And what's incredible is that the entire world realizes this. All around the world, we've got people looking at the United States and going, whoa, something bad going on there. I mean, you know, something really scary. Here, George Bush proposing to bomb Al Jazeera. Top secret document from the Prime Minister's office, Tony Blair's office, shows that the U.S. President George W. Bush planned to bomb the satellite TV station Al Jazeera, despite it being owned by the Qatari government, a key U.S. ally. What's he going to do? Is he going to do it like he's going to wire explosives in the building? I mean, Al Jazeera is headquartered in a country where we have our military bases. It's our ally. He's going to blow it up and blame it on somebody else. Say, well, that was Osama bin Laden who blew that thing up. Who knows? But the British now are saying, hey, we want to read the transcript. Five-page transcript where Blair is talking Bush out of bombing Al Jazeera. Wild. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. On the Tom Hartman radio program, the true people's radio, common sense and truth in broadcasting for a change. Yeah, it's a double entendre. Welcome back. Nancy Anton is with us with NewsHounds.us. We watch Fox so you don't have to is their slogan. Thank God somebody is to tell us about it, you know, with a rational point of view here. Hey, Nancy.
Hi, how are you?
I am just great. Thank you very much for being with us. And what are the Roger Ailes clones up to this day?
Well, my colleague Melanie caught a great one yesterday on Cavuto, your world,
mm-hmm.
Neil Cavuto.
Mm-hmm.
They were discussing the 30,000 layoffs.
At General Motors.
At General Motors.
Right.
And there was Cavuto and another Fox person, Dagan McDowell, and two guests. And all four of them agreed that it's better for everyone.
You know, it's the old...
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Yes, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain, says the great and all-powerful wizard. Oh, my. So it's better for all of us. What possible contortion of logic did the Foxies use or whatever? What? By the way, what do you call the folks who are on Fox?
I bet you can say
on the air.
On the air,
yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, let's call them the Foxies then. What possible contortion of logic would they use to say that it's better for all of us that General Motors is laying off 25,000 Americans and 30,000 people around the world?
One of the guests, Jonathan Honig, said people will rely on their own efforts
to build a car? I'll build a car in my backyard. Yes, indeed. And not only that, I'll employ myself and I'll give myself health insurance. And if I get sick, I'll operate on myself. Is that what he was talking about? It seems to be the case.
Yep.
Oh, my. Okay.
And Wayne Rogers, who apparently is a frequent guest on Cavuto, said there's no guarantees anymore and people are going to have to work it out differently.
Well, in a way, you know, they're echoing Alan Greenspan's comments back to the Wall Street Journal in 1999, where he said that he saw part of his job responsibility as being to maintain a certain level of what he referred to as, and I'm quoting Alan Greenspan, to maintain a certain level of, quote, worker insecurity, end quote.
Right.
That if you have full employment in the United States, then you have workers who will feel that they can organize into labor unions and they can demand more wages and more pay, and that will make corporations less profitable, and that will mean that the ownership class will not have as large a return on their investments, and that wouldn't be a good thing from their point of view.
Warped, but you're absolutely right. Yep.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is solid. I mean, this is their, really and truly, it is their worldview. And they really think that they create jobs. They don't get it that they use labor in order to produce goods and services that people buy. I mean, it's bizarre. Anyhow, what else on Fox, Nancy?
Britt Hume does this segment on Special Report every night called Grapevine, and he's four little blurbs.
Mm-hmm.
And they focus on the most minute stories that really have no national relevance at all. And last night they were doing their academic jihad, is what we call it,
mm-hmm.
attacking professors, basically.
Right.
Just another example. John Daly, a professor at a community college in New Jersey, over an email he sent to a student, and the right-wing blogosphere picks this up, and now the college is being deluged with hate mail and hate phone calls and stuff.
Right.
Absolutely this typical.
This is a strategy of taking a little tiny thing, blowing it up huge, and using it to, again, say, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain, to divert our attention away from the very real problems of America.
Exactly.
How goes their campaign freaking America out that the nasty retailers are trying to de-Christianize us?
Oh, that's a good one. Deborah, who monitors John Gibson.
Yeah.
John Gibson has written a book about Christmas and how Christians are being persecuted because you can't say Merry Christmas and that kind of thing, right?
Yes, this poor majority in this country.
Right. So Deborah has actually counted that since October 30th, he's done 9 separate segments on this issue, and each time it's to promote his book.
Yeah, of course.
Which
incredible.
Is, another problem with Fox that they do all the time. Half of their people that they interview and their guests and their consultants and contributors are there to promote a book.
Right. Yeah, I know, and it's unseemly. I mean, speaking as the author of a whole bunch of books.
They don't disclose it and make viewers aware of that's what's going on.
Yeah. Nancy, we have a little less than half a minute left. I'm just wondering how Fox is dealing with Mirtha and what's her name? Mean Jean, calling him a traitor.
They were all over Mirtha the first day it happened. And then they suddenly backed off.
Yeah. And Jean Schmidt, are they coming to her defense?
Yes and no. I haven't seen it. But who knows what will happen tonight. It's the primetime shows, and I think they were waiting to see last night. They really weren't on it last night.
To see how it all shake out. Because the guy that she quoted is now, the Marine that she quoted is now on the record as saying, I never mentioned John Murtha's name, and I never used the word coward. And so it looks like Gene Schmidt just, made this whole thing up, or else this guy is trying to weasel out of it. It's incredible. Nancy Anton, newshounds.us. They watch Fox, so you don't have to. Check it out. Thanks, Nancy, for being with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Not for me, I used to be. I want to see this through. I left the
Hey, welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk radio for the rest of us, for all of us, exposing the con in conservative. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. As far as the job of president goes, said Jack Kennedy. 42 years ago today, assassinated. As far as the job of president goes, it's rewarding, and I've given before this group the definition of happiness for the Greeks. I'll define it again. The full use of your power along lines of excellence. I find, therefore, that the presidency provides some happiness. That's fascinating. You wonder if George W. Bush thinks, in his wildest dreams, that the definition of happiness would be the full use of your powers along the lines of excellence, and that he's pursuing excellence in his presidency. Somehow, I suspect that would be a totally alien concept to him. But, who knows? 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466, our telephone number. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thank you. I have a comment to make before I get to Mirtha. You have great bumper music.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm waiting for I Owe My Soul to the Company Store by Tennessee Ernie Ford.
Oh, that's
a
great
one.
I'll pass that. Louise does most of our bumpers, and I'll pass that along to her. I remember that. Wow. That's a way back machine one. Yeah, it is.
And I heard on the top of the hour the news about CNN mistakenly putting a blinking X over Dick Cheney's face.
Yes.
I thought, that's very apropos as well, because he is obscene.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, there are no accidents. I mean, you know, it's of course, the right wing is trying to portray it as some terrible conspiracy on the part of the engineers at CNN. I think it's the universe trying to tell us something.
Oh, I agree.
But, you know, this for all of Pat Robertson's followers, this is a message from God.
Exactly.
So.
Well, explain it to me, Lucy. I finally have a hero in Murtha from my home state, because the last time I was proud of any politician from my home state was, let's see, never. And what does stuck in the 90s Hillary do? I don't understand the DLCers, that they need a 21st century playbook, because they lose with that 90s Republican light stuff, and then they end up blaming progressives whenever they do lose.
And Murtha is not a progressive.
Exactly.
I mean, Murtha is as middle of the road as you can get on this one issue.
Exactly.
He's a very solid guy. On a lot of other issues, I strongly disagree with him, but he at least had the courage of his convictions to stand up and speak out. And a lot of folks inside the Beltway are saying that because Murtha has the ear of the senior brass in the military, particularly the Marine Corps, that it's not Murtha who's speaking when you hear his lips move and words come out of his mouth with regard to military issues. It is the senior brass in the military speaking. And the senior brass in the military are freaked out right now.
But why does not Hillary do this? I don't understand her.
Has she attacked Murtha?
She said she came out and said, I have to catch up on my newspaper reading. This is something I heard on a different talk show, but a reliable source, that, you know, now is not the time to pull out.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people saying that, and Murtha didn't suggest that we should pull out now. He was talking about taking, you know, anywhere from a month to a year, you know, with probably about 6 months to pull out, but doing it in a reasonable and rational way that would guarantee the safety of the troops. So, you know, Bonnie, thanks a lot for the call. It's and by the way, congratulations on Jack Murtha. I tried to call his office actually yesterday just to say hi and thank him for what he had done and ask if there was some way that I could send him $20 or, you know, some small but symbolic contribution. And I was never able to get through on the telephone. The line was busy for, you know, half hour or so I finally gave up. But anyhow, I think, you know, good on him. He said as he walks through the halls of Congress, people burst into applause. You know, well done. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yes, thanks very much for your hard work and your comments from President Kennedy. The reason I called is the Patriot Act.
Its
position now is that the Senate and the House are negotiating a final bill. And most of what the House wanted appears to be winning the day. But there is a bipartisan group of 3 Democrat and 3 Republican senators who are trying to salvage at least a little bit of our Fourth Amendment rights. And if people would call both their congressmen and their senators and ask them to support these relatively modest changes, it's at least an effort to salvage some of our rights out of this.
Isn't it tragic, Jim, that we're talking about, gee, let's support a half measure, because if we don't, we're going to be toast?
Yeah. It's nothing to be I'm not happy that this is where we are, but at least if we do this, it's the best we can get right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can call your member of Congress at 202-225-3121 and simply ask for, you know, by name, or if you don't know the name of you who represents you, either in the House of Representatives or the names of your senators, simply tell tell the operator who answers what state you're in, or in the case of the House of Representatives, give them your zip code, and they'll connect you with the office of the person who is your representative.
And these 6 people, the Republicans are Craig of Idaho, Sununu of New Hampshire, and Murkowski of Alaska, and Durbin of Illinois is a Democrat, Salazar of Colorado, and Feingold of Wisconsin. This is a very broad spectrum of senators.
Yeah,
and they're thankfully, you know, they're really trying. This is in regard to the sneak and peek, especially.
Without getting super hyper technical about it, I mean, the bottom line of what they're proposing is that historically we have had a separation of powers in the United States. In order for the executive branch to exercise its police powers, The executive branch, for example, runs the FBI. In order for the executive branch to exercise its police powers to come into your house, for example, and snoop, they have to go to the judicial branch, to another branch of government, and have the judicial branch look at the activity of the legislative branch, the third branch, that made the law, and say, okay, under this law, the evidence that you, the executive branch, the presidential bunch, have given to us indicates that there may have been a crime committed here. Yeah, and that's the Fourth Amendment. You know, somebody has sworn that there's a crime or there's evidence of a crime, and therefore, given probable cause of a crime, we will issue a search warrant so that you can then, the executive branch, the FBI guys, you can then break into this person's house or whatever. And so there's always been this checks and balances that really, in a very real way, has involved all three branches of government. What the Patriot Act did and what they're proposing to make permanent is to eliminate the executive branch and, you know, the legislative branch basically voting to eliminate the executive branch, or the judicial branch, rather, so that now the executive branch, the presidential branch, the FBI, can simply go to itself and request a warrant and say, gee, we'd like a warrant from ourselves. Okay, I guess we'll give ourselves a warrant. And they don't have to run it by a judge, and they don't have to prove probable cause, and it's not something that can be appealed, and it's not a matter of public record, and that's the formula for a police state. And that's what's before Congress right now. And
week,
and
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Last week, your listeners called the Congress and the Senate and put off until January discussions over the extradition treaty, which would have taken extradition out of judicial and into the executive branch. So it's going to be an open. There's going to be a discussion and an open forum in January before the Foreign Relations Committee. Thanks to the people in the United States who called their senators because. I can't remember the one right now, but he said that his people and all the representatives have gotten so many calls that mm-hmm. they're not going to conduct a closed meeting and it's going to be an open meeting. And, right. and that was a great victory. It's stalling until January, but it was a victory, and we need to do this one too. And I hate to sound like some kind of a nut because it is hard
no,
to
it's, you're sounding like a patriot here, Jim. Excuse me. I mean, this is. Let me give you the toll-free number: 888-888-355-3588. 888-355-3588. Toll-free to Congress, or if you have free long distance, want to pay for the call, 202-225-3121. That paid-for number is sometimes a little more reliable. Toll-free, 888-355-3588. And just tell your member of Congress, we don't want to give up any more rights under the Patriot Act. Do everything you can to stop these crazies. Or, you know, whatever's appropriate. Jim, thanks a lot for the call and for raising the issue. It's an important one and one that we should all be working on. Bill in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. A great, great show. I really want to thank you for the theme of the show today, Jack Kennedy and liberalism. And I'll tell you, with the 2006 election coming on, the question, you know, all of the questions you're talking about liberalism are the ones that I'm going to be asking the candidates.
Good.
But and also that you know that Jean Schmidt business. She's from Southern Ohio, and as you know, and
yep. You're going to disavow her, eh?
Oh, most definitely, and that's why I'm going to work for Paul Hackett for Senate to unseat DeWine. But I was a Marine rifleman during Vietnam, and I'm going to tell you something. And I'm against the war in Iraq. If those people want to call me a coward, I consider myself in good company. Real quickly, this Thanksgiving. I am grateful that the American people are finally coming around and that people like Jack Murtha are standing up and saying enough is enough.
Mm-hmm. I am, too, and that's something to be grateful for this Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it's reminding me that the American people aren't stupid like a lot of people say they are. It may take them a while to come around. Of course, you know, if you're not informed, you don't know, but thank God the American people are finally coming around, and I agree with you and so many others that liberalism is going to save our democracy.
Yeah, it has. It always has in the past. It's the basis of our democracy. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Great
thank
to hear
you.
From you. And thank you for your service to our country. I appreciate hearing from you. And, yeah, we have a lot to be thankful for. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's a long, long road from which there is no return.
I think we can return from the insanity that these people have dragged us into since Ronald Reagan and his extremist right-wing agenda came into power. I really do think we can take back America. We can bring this country back to its greatness. I really do. And if we simply hold to the values that the founders held for this country and that have been articulated in those shining moments of brilliance when this country actually rose up to embrace at least some of the ideals on which it was founded. Carol in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Carol, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Wondered if you saw Jimmy Carter on Jay Leno last night.
No, I didn't. I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to do a morning show here in Portland, and so I'm asleep at 7. So I don't have the luxury of watching Jay Leno.
He was wonderful.
What did I miss?
He's written 20 books, and his latest book is his first political book, and it's called Our Endangered Values, and it's number one on the bestseller list right now.
Yes, I haven't read it, but I'm familiar with it.
It sounds like an excellent book. But
yes,
it
does.
He's very upset with this administration, too, and like John Murtha, he's really speaking out.
Yeah, and he's a statesman.
Yeah,
I mean that's the thing. Jimmy Carter was never a hack politician.
No,
you know he took us through some dark times. We were living through the consequences of the failed economic policies of Ronald Reagan, where he tried to bankrupt the government so that he could stop social spending. Jimmy Carter had to deal with that. He had to deal with Nixon, going back to Nixon and LBJ for that matter, the failed guns and butter policy and all this sort of thing. And you know, Carter really was dealing with some difficult crises. Our having installed the Shah in Iran, you know, overthrowing Mossadegh and putting in the Shah. Carter had to deal with that. But he look back at what he actually did, and particularly with regard to energy policy and the Middle East. And Jimmy Carter was a true statesman.
Yes, he was. One of the last ones.
Carol, thanks for calling and reminding us about that.
Alrighty.
Much appreciated. Good to hear from you. Tony in Seattle, Washington. Hey, from one coast to the other. Hey, Tony.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just great.
Maybe even one of the last libertarians. I don't know. I mean,
who's that? You?
I'm talking about Jimmy Carter. I just on the last caller. So.
Oh yeah, Jimmy Carter's not a libertarian. He's a liberal.
Okay. I just meant a true liberal, I should say.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the libertarians, you know, it sounds good. They want to legalize drugs and prostitution on the one hand, you know, personal freedom and all that. But on the other hand, they want to let corporations run our government. They don't think that the government should run our government, that we should privatize everything.
Not a healthy thing. My point was, though, America seems to run good under strong unions and everybody being employed. So I don't understand how all of a sudden the Republicans think that, you know, people being unemployed, you know, or having fear within their job place, you know, even at Boeing, I'm here in the Northwest, Boeing or even Microsoft isn't, you know, that secure of a place these days. I'm just, you know, I'm wondering why would they want to do this to people when they're taking out new loans on their houses and, you know, trying to invest in places that they really can't afford. Spend, you know, like Sammy Davis Jr., you know, he said, I spend beyond my means. I think a lot of people do that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I don't think it's that these guys are sitting, you know, the CEO class, shall we say, or the investor class. And it's really a relatively small number of people. We're talking about probably fewer than 20,000 people in the United States, probably fewer than 500 companies who have basically designed the economic policy of this country since 1980. And
right.
It's not that they're looking at folks like you and me and saying, oh, let's, you know, screw the working guy. You know, let's make it hard for it's not that. It's they're asking the question, how can they get the greatest return? How can they get the most money in their own pockets? And the fact of the matter is that they've sucked enormous amounts of money out of the middle class in America. And now they're trying to suck money out of the rest of the world. They've gone global. And going global means that you don't care about what's going on in the United States anymore. They're not patriots.
The spine of the liberal, I think, is in question a lot of times because, like, I have to say, listen, I'm being on hold. I'll let you go on your show. It's a pleasure because of Earthwatch.com and a couple of other shows that you run like that where I'm not convinced that, I mean, yeah, I know you need commercials to make your business run, but here you're giving me information that is, you know, valuable And it's like,
well, that goes out on our web stream. The local stations have to sell commercials during that time.
Yeah,
there's
something going on there. I appreciate that, man.
Yeah. I appreciate it too, Tony, and thanks for the call. The thing about, you know, during radio stations sell local commercials during certain times in our breaks, and if you listen to those local commercials and you buy the products from those local vendors, that keeps this show on the air, and it's really important. Now, we've got to fill that time on the web stream and on the satellite just so it's not dead air, and so we run, you know, programs like Earthwatch and whatnot. But I'm not ever going to criticize local affiliates for running advertising. In fact, I encourage you to please embrace the advertisers that you're hearing. Aaron in Tacoma, Washington, we just have about a minute left. Aaron, what's up?
Oh, yeah, I have just really saddened by the loss of those GM jobs. And it seems like, you know, from the firing of the air traffic controllers under Reagan, you know.
You can draw a straight line from that moment in time to today, Aaron.
Absolutely. And, you know, and CAFTA is the capper. But, you know, in between, there are a number of milestones where we could have done something.
Yeah.
NAFTA, WTO, the permanent most favored nation status given to China.
The problem was that Bill Clinton drank the same Kool-Aid. I really think that he believed in his heart that it was the right thing to do. And these guys, you know, this was going to be a brand new economic model. It was something that's never been tried before in the world. Let's try it. Let's just throw the doors open and let every country compete on a level playing field, regardless of their internal needs, regardless of their labor situation. Let's just, you know, kick the door out and let the corporations write the rules. And they'll do it, hopefully, in a way that the market will decide what's best for everybody. And Clinton was wrong. It's just that simple. Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. And, you know, Clinton was wrong, Reagan was wrong, Bush Sr. was wrong, and Bush Jr. is wrong. It helps the investor class, like I said, probably about 20,000 people in the United States, a few hundred corporations, and it screws the middle class. It harms medium and small businesses. It harms those businesses that are purely in America and incorporated in America, and it's disemboweling, cutting the guts out of the middle class in America. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.